Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Eastern European Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I am Vladislav Lilic, a doctoral candidate in modern European history at Vanderbilt University and a host on the channel. In today's podcast, I'm delighted to greet Dr. John Connolly, professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley. We will be discussing his monumental new book, From Peoples into Nations, History of Eastern Europe, published by Princeton University Press earlier this year. Immediately taking pride of place on graduate reading lists in modern Eastern European history, From Peoples into Nations is an encyclopedic but lively narrative that captivates both those familiar with old stories about the region and novices who are seeking introduction to this vast laboratory of European modernity. Passionate, erudite, and insightful, the book pursues answers to the central question of Eastern European history. Why does nationalism persist as the organizing principle of political life in a region where it has produced such tragedies? Dr. Connolly, welcome to New Books in Eastern European Studies. And thank you for taking the time to talk to me about your book.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
Our listeners will be familiar with your fascinating work on Eastern European universities under High Stalinism. How has your previous research led you to write a synthesis of the region's modern history?
Well, I would say actually this book is related more to my teaching than my research. I've been teaching East European history for almost 30 years now, and this is in some ways a summation of what I've been trying to tell the students over that period. So obviously it's connected to the research in the sense that I was living in Eastern Europe for a number of years in the 1980s, and I think I absorbed a lot of the questions that interested people in the region. So there's an earlier way in which this book is connected to that earlier research. The earlier research, by the way, was almost entirely about the Stalinist years, whereas this book, as you know, goes back to the 18th century. So the roots of this book are both in research and teaching, but I think more directly in teaching, actually.
There is no geography without politics. How have you resolved the conundrum of spatially delineating Eastern Europe? Where is this region in your narrative? What are its boundaries and relations with some neighboring worlds, Mitteleuropa or the Islamic Near East, for instance?
Yeah, so the way that I do this, and this is the way I've chosen to do this in teaching as well for many years, is I talk about the region as a region of experience. There's no point in trying to delineate exact lines in the map where Eastern Europe begins and ends. It's the same with some of the individual nations and even nation states, like Poland, for example, wasn't on the map in the 19th century, yet there was a Poland, in a sense. So the common experience is one of a sense and a politics, a discourse, if you will, of belonging to small peoples, threatened by their large neighbors to the extent of the danger of becoming extinct. I mean, that was an argument that was used from the 18th century onward, and that's actually why my book begins in the 18th century. The neighboring areas in this discourse or in this understanding are, of course, areas that are thought of as being historically imperial. German, meaning German Prussia, German Austria, the Russian Empire, as well as the Ottoman Empire. So in all of the local national narratives, there's a sense of the German or the Turk or the Russian representing something from the outside that could stifle and destroy what is on the inside, namely the national existence. So that's that. That's so I, you know, this, the short answer is simply that it's a region of small peoples between larger imperial entities that has a common sense of the fragility of history and understands that nations in history come and go, and the national discourses are built in a way that supports the idea that everything needs to be devoted to the effort to maintain the nation.
Burgeoning scholarship under the rubric of national indifference has maintained rather forcefully that national identities were a relatively late product of modern state building in supranational dynastic polities, Habsburg, the Hohenzollern, Ottoman, and Romanov. How does From Peoples into Nations engage with this line of argumentation?
Well, I first have to say that I've extremely value this approach. And when I was a student in Poland, I actually spent a lot of time in Upper Silesia, which is a place that is renowned for a population that somewhere falls between two major nationalities, the, you know, or national discourses, the German and the Polish. But I understand that, in fact, I've actually spent time with families where there are members who felt they could go in either direction or in no direction, that they would call themselves simply locals. And this is as late as the 1980s. But my view is that this is relatively exceptional for the region, that this is a borderland phenomenon, this phenomenon of so-called national indifference, where there are, you know, significant numbers of people who feel they fall between nationalities and don't opt for any nationality and are happy being bi or trilingual. In my view, the main story, and this is found throughout the region, is in fact the advance of the nationalist narrative from Poland down to Serbia, including, you know, Bulgaria, the Czech lands, Hungary. In a very, very similar way, there are efforts from the late 18th century by politically involved, culturally involved individuals to resurrect the basic coordinates, the basic substance of nationhood, above all language, as is well known, but also a sense of history and then political organization. And these histories don't begin suddenly in the 18th century, but go back earlier. One of the points that I make in my book very strongly is that in the case of much of the South Slav area, there was a very old tradition of oral folk poetry in which populations, mostly illiterate, told themselves stories about the past and who they were, which formed a solid resource for later nationalist movements. So that I would dispute the idea that nationalism is purely something that emerges in the 18th century. You know, it solidifies and adopts a new political form from the late 18th century onward, but it's not completely new. And there was also a very large number of especially people of gentry background in Hungary and Poland, early modern Hungary and Poland, who had a very distinct sense of local identity that is a precursor, an important precursor to modern nationalism. I could talk at much greater length about this, but my view is that the modern literature on nationalism has stressed the way in which nationalism is contingent. Even an individual decision doesn't need to happen. Whereas what I stress is the pattern of the very same kind, very similar kinds of the development of nationalist narratives throughout the region, from the Baltic states down to through the Balkans and through Central Europe over the period extending from the late 18th century to the late 19th century.
To unpack this further, you define Eastern Europe as an anti-imperial space of small nations, and write that anti-imperial struggle kept ethnic cultures alive, but it also promoted ideologies of exclusion that can become racist. How has the historical experience of living in between empires and absorbing these existential, political, and cultural, linguistic even threats molded Eastern European modernities? Perhaps elaborate on a few examples.
It's not a, the interesting thing is, and I think that the newer literature is very good about this, it's not a heroic story, right? It's portrayed that way within the regions being a heroic story. But in essence, the Czech national narrative, for example, is formulated as an anti-German narrative. So that if the Czechs are one thing, the Germans are another, right? And the most basic distinction, of course, is that the Czechs are so-called small people, whereas the Germans are a large, supposedly aggressive imperial people. And you know, the entire Czech modern political understanding from the mid 19th century actually grows upon these presuppositions. There's a way in which, of course, the Polish national narrative is set against perceptions, representations of what German and Russian imperialism have meant. This makes for very, very high stakes within the Polish political discourse about what counts as sufficiently properly Polish politics, right? And this extends to this day. It's extraordinary, you know, at this late date that anti-Germanism could make such a strong appearance so many years after World War II within the Polish political discourse. But it comes back again and again, and it has these deeper roots in the sense of being caught between empires. There is, of course, also there are all kinds of parallel stereotypes within the Serb nationalist discourse about historical Turkish Ottoman rule that also make for very high stakes for being a properly national politician within the Serb political realm. And it's, you know, it's extraordinary in the Bosnian, again, in recent years in the Bosnian context, to see ways in which very old understandings of what is foreign and what is properly native reemerge and are used to try to establish space between various Serb political parties, right? And so throughout the region, you see this a way in which this anti-imperialist discourse makes for very high stakes to be properly counted as a national politician. And this historically extends even to into the socialist movement. I mean, one of the things that I found striking in researching the late 19th century is the way in which the Czech Social Democratic Party, which was Marxist, as you know, found that it had to completely accept this governing narrative of so-called bohemian states' rights and deny any local administrative entities that might favor the German language, which would have been, at the time, the idea of there being administrative entities in Bohemia that would have permitted the flourishing of German language would have been a sensible kind of compromise to the heated political struggle of the 1890s. But this was something that if a Czech Marxist were to accept, that Czech Marxist soon found himself, and these were usually men outflanked by other socialists who called themselves more nationalist. That was the founding of the Czech National Socialist Party in the late 1890s. So there's a way in which there's a presence of a sense of outside threat that can always be brought into politics. It seems almost in every generation. That's the major feature of politics that it distinguishes this region, by the way, from Western Europe, where this sort of sense of threat is not as strong. One exception I'll mention: I had a sabbatical in Northern Ireland recently, and I learned that actually within Northern Ireland you find very very similar kinds of pressures to create sense of political correctness, if you will, or national political correctness among politicians of the so-called loyalist and the nationalist side. So it's not a uniquely East European thing, but this post-imperial consciousness across this band of countries does create a very peculiar kind of environment and long-lasting concerns within political discourse.
Focus strongly on the political role of language, especially early on in the Czech case. Perhaps care to elaborate on how these early Czech nationalists in the early 19th century saw their own culture as being threatened by the much vaster, larger German cultural complex.
Yeah, so the Czech case, this is not my original finding, but it's something that's been studied by a number of people throughout the decades. Hugh Agnew, for example, in the United States, Miroslav Hroch, famously in the Czech case. This is considered a paradigmatic case of linguistic nationalism because it represents a concern among a very, very small group of scholars and intellectuals, in this case in the late 18th century, that the vernacular had declined in a way that made it vulnerable to being superseded by what was considered the imperial language, so German in that case. And so, as is well known, these relatively small groups of scholars over several generations did what they could to bring the language back to life, to resuscitate it. So it's a well-known story how people like Jungmann and Dobrovsky actually created new words. They took words from other Slavic languages to take the place of Czech language words that had been lost. They tried to purge the language of Germanisms, all in an effort to make sure that this basic substance of what they viewed as Czech nationhood be preserved. But it's interesting to note that they were, although nationalism, you know, itself lives by exaggerating outside threats. There was a very live threat in this period, the late 18th century, coming from Habsburg authorities to replace Czech with German, simply because the authorities thought that, and with good reason, that German would be more useful for state building purposes. Right. So Joseph II, the Habsburg leader of the 1780s, he was concerned about making a strong state and believed German would be the best way to do that, and thereby he made people, children in the Bohemian lands, literate in Czech, so that they could then learn German and become, you know, properly useful subjects. So he did not intend, he did not see himself as a German nationalist, but the effect of these measures to try to replace as much as possible Czech with German also in the Hungarian lands was to arouse a sense among Czech and Hungarian elites that their languages, these languages, might disappear. So I find this sensitivity was rooted in a real sense of threat. But it's interesting that it was very focused. There were at most dozens of scholars who were concerned about this in the Bohemian lands. Yet this sensitivity spread, and that's what I find remarkable and difficult actually to explain, is that this concern with the disappearance of language actually spread and motivated, hundreds, then thousands, then tens of thousands of people in the Czech lands to become politically active and do things, to create institutions to maintain, to resuscitate and maintain that language. We could get into why that was the case, but that's the basic story is there, and in other places, in Poland as well. And as you probably know, in the South Slav lands of, you know, in this very period, early 19th century, of scholars coming together and trying to do what they can to resuscitate vernaculars that had fallen into disuse and were no longer written or used in scholarly language, and then make them, a basic tool for creating later nation states, national state entities.
Excellent segue into my next question. It has been quite popular among scholars to discuss the so-called sociological depth of nationalism. When does it become a mass popular phenomenon in your narrative? People like Rogers Brubaker or Peter Judson would still insist that for a very long time it remains an elite top-down project. Where do you see it as becoming a mass phenomenon, something that has wider social reverberations? And how does that process work?
Right. Well, I actually rely upon the work of a Polish scholar named Henryk Wereszycki, relatively little known in the West, but very well known in Poland. So he locates the spread, sort of the mass spread of a sense of Czechness and the need to create Czech institutions to the 1830s and 1840s. And it has to do in part with processes also of modernization, the spread of schooling and modern forms of communication, what Miroslav Proch calls social communication, the fact that Czechs from further and further away from each other were coming into frequent contact, coming into towns to do business with each other. So that it became, in the 1830s and 1840s, practical, reasonable, efficient, effective. This is the theory of Karl Deutsch, for Czech speakers, in fact, to rely upon their language and their common sense of Czechness to do very practical things, make money, for example, right, to build businesses, to expand markets, to do advertising, right, to travel beyond the boundaries of the city of Prague into the outlying areas and find new customers. because of the widespread presence of the vernacular that was that now becoming a written and spoken language, it made practical sense. In fact, people had a concrete benefit by going out and using the Czech language among Czech speakers. So, and you know, what's interesting in the 1840s is that some of the great later, the famous Czech nationalists of a later period were demanding from Austrian authorities things like trade schools, right? The permission to make use of the Czech language simply to make young Czech people able to do business and to pursue crafts in the vernacular, clearly because that was considered to be useful and beneficial as social communication spread. So I would say by, you know, this is again not my own finding, but by the 1850s, certainly 1860s, it's a mass phenomenon. This is a relatively brief period, by the way, right? From the pioneers, Palatsky was still considered himself to be a relative outsider in the 1830s. By the 1850s, 60s, the environment of Prague or Brno, other cities, has changed, and there's a very strong Czech presence by that point. People are aware of themselves as being Czech, and they find it useful to be Czech. But so there's this practical element, right, of social communication, but there's also a less tangible, I would say more idealistic element that goes hand in hand. It's inseparable from that. The gradual formation of an ideology of Czechness, the idea that it's valuable and important to think of oneself as part of a people that goes back many centuries, in fact, into time immemorial, has suffered oppression, looks upon a series of proud rulers in the Middle Ages and earlier, right? In fact, lays claim to the territory of the Czech lands for historical reasons. There's the documents forged in the early 19th century. All of this sense of it being a very important thing for a person to be Czech. Also, at a time of increasing secularization and the decline of organized religion, this goes hand in hand with the more practical way in which being Czech is a way of simply advancing in the modern world. At the same time, one advances with a certain kind of ideological passion and fervor and insistence that one has to pass this sense of Czech identity onto one's children, that it's a mission that one has in life, like a religion, right? So I think where I really benefit from the use of Vereshchitsky, the Polish author, and others, is the way in which one sees in the 19th century, thanks to processes of modernization, the expansion of markets, the growth of modern schools and modern means of communication, railroads and the like, but also this very intense concern by national patriots like Palatsky with creating this mythology that nationalism has these two elements that are inseparable. By the 1880s, the idea of being a good Czech or a good Pole is something that no one can ignore, right? And the way ultimately that nationalism succeeds is by shaming those who presume to stay on the outside, and you see this really throughout the region, right? I mean, it's nationalism. I've been thinking more about this recently, just in light of other readings I've been reading on the French Revolution recently. Nationalism is above all a language, right? While it also fosters language, right, the development of vernacular, it is its own language with its own set of understandings of what is valuable in life. That suddenly one finds oneself in the middle of, right? Say a Czech were to fall asleep in the 1840s and wake up in the 1870s, suddenly that Czech speaker would have found him or herself surrounded by expectations that weren't as strong, were not as present in the 1840s. But by the 1870s, you couldn't ignore, we could go on at greater length about this. To sum up, these sort of practical considerations of being a successful person in a modern society, they combine perfectly and inseparably from this more idealistic almost quasi-religious form of nationalism. It happens at the very same time.
As the 19th century comes to a close, could a good Czech still be loyal to the House Habsburg? Could a good Pole or a good Serb be a Russian or an Ottoman subject? In other words, when do nationalist projects become directly opposed to the older imperial frameworks of rule in the region?
Yeah, that's a great question. Peter Judson and others have said very accurately that no one among Czech nationalists was considering there or demanding that there be necessarily a Czech national entity, let us say, in the even in the years right up before World War I. The expectation on the part of even the right, the Czech nationalists, and part of Masaryk and people to his right, was that they would, for into the foreseeable future, would remain Habsburg subjects and would strive to have some kind of Czech representation as loyal Habsburg subjects. I think it's certainly the case also, you know, on the Polish right. Domowski did all that he could, you know, within reason, to collaborate with Tsarist authorities. And Serbia, you know, I think that the sense is stronger that one has to separate oneself from Ottoman authorities, certainly in Serbia proper as it grows in the 19th century, collaborate, but then separate oneself as quickly as possible. But in the Habsburg lands, yes, indeed, I think into World War I, there was a sense that one not only could be, but had to be a loyal Habsburg subject. But it's interesting that as soon as the war breaks out, I mean, within months of the war breaking out, Masaryk and South Slav politicians, you know, the later Yugoslav committee, are already imagining, they escape, right? They leave the Habsburg lands and they go to the West and they begin, in a sense, openly practicing subversion. They pursue the creation of Czech and Czechoslovak and Yugoslav states. So World War I is the point at which this kind of loyalty then breaks down, I would say. In the case of Masaryk, it has to do also with the argument and you know, the fact that the Habsburg authorities, they did a lot to actively persecute Slavic politicians, leading to imprisonments and even mass executions for treason. So World War I is really where all of this breaks down, I would say, and where so that by 1918 there's you know, widespread, universal, I would say, understanding in the Czech lands that the place to go now is away from the Habsburgs and into an independent Czechoslovak Republican nationhood.
An interesting thread to follow. What is the relationship between war and nationalism in the first half of the 20th century in Eastern Europe? Is it fair to say that war strengthens, crystallizes national movements and sentiments? Or could we also argue that it causes some sort of a nationalist fatigue, especially after the Second World War?
It does both. That's it. You formulate the question perfectly. So I think during the war itself, take the Polish lands or South Slav area. Indeed, these resistance movements emerge that are popular and extremely active, and at the risk of people's lives. Poles are conspiring from 1940 onward. This is, by the way, connected to an earlier quote-unquote romantic heritage, right? And that's why I think it's important that a book on Eastern Europe also look very carefully at the 19th century. That's one of the things I discovered while writing my book, was that I began thinking I'd be writing about the 1940s, but I couldn't really write about the 1940s without looking at the 1840s at the same time. So the experience of the Warsaw Underground during World War II is indeed one of increasing stakes of national loyalty. And you see this in the memoirs of Czesław Miłosz, right, where he's accused of being a poor Pole because he doesn't actually, or a bad Pole, because he just doesn't get involved in the actual armed fighting, say, in 1944. So during the war, there's an extraordinary pressure upon especially young people to become involved in Poland, at least in this national resistance. But again, you know, staying within Poland then experiences several years of vicious civil war after the war, various kinds of formations fighting each other. And I think, so the word you use, exhaustion, by 1947-48, I think that society is exhausted and is ready for something new. That is, I think, what explains the openness on the part of a lot of intellectuals, also many young people, to openly embrace the Marxist regime, at least to go along with it and try to make their peace with it. You see this on the part of a lot of, you know, survivors of the wartime underground. Take, for example, the Polish writer Jacek Czernadl, who later became pretty well known as a staunch figure on the right. He also made his peace and produced Soviet-style literature during the early 1950s. But the cases differ. I don't want to go into all of them. Don't know them as well as the Polish case. You don't see quite the same fervor, for example, in the Czech lands. I think the national movement there found that the nation state itself had failed them by acceding to the German demands at Munich in 1938. So there's a large degree of resignation and, you know, relatively small national movement in the Czech lands. But for that reason, if Poland is exhausted by nationalism after World War II, in some ways Czech nationalism is revived and turns upon Germans 1945-46, but then upon Czechs themselves, the Czech national spectrum becomes incredibly viciously divided, left and right, but also along the lines of the better and the worse national, supposedly national politics. But anyway, so wars have precisely the effect that you describe. I think they awaken a sense of national nationalist fervor, but then there's a down cycle. And in the Czech lands, that would be the time after the Slánský trial, or the mid 1950s. That society is exhausted by several years of this kind of witch hunt for traitors, national traitors, right? That's how Slánský and the others were identified, as being national traitors. When Stalin dies, all of that suddenly calms down, and the party leadership itself ceases to behave in that way. Stalinism itself was a time when there was fear of imminent war, so it fits into what you describe as a wartime, in a sense.
Brings me to my next question. You admire your thesis that nationalism served as a vessel through which other ideologies in the region were reworked or negotiated, including liberalism, fascism, corporatism, Marxism, international socialism. Could you elucidate that thesis by offering a few examples of this uneasy relationship and this reworking of other ideological projects through nationalism?
Well, I don't know about reworking. Adaptation would be maybe the better sense. Look, National Socialism itself is primarily nationalist. It emerges from the region very strongly in Austria, but also Hungary, from the 1890s to the 1930s. It's a response. I mean, I talk about it. This is also known as fascism, by the way, National Socialism. It's a response against liberalism, usually by intellectuals of the center left who move rightward by claiming that liberalism itself has failed the common people, the folk, the Narod, right? So in a sense, this is a direct continuation, in a way, also distortion of early liberal nationalism. All nationalism in the 1840s is liberal, right? I mean, there is, of course, there's socialism emerging, but basically the national movements of the 1840s are liberal. The challenges come by the late 1870s, throughout the 1880s. The drama, the greatest drama in this sense, is therefore on the emerging left among socialists, and, you know, relying on the work of others who've preceded me, like Jakub Benes, for example, has written very eloquently about this in the Czech case. What one sees is the way in which social democrats, followers of Marx and Engels themselves, find that from Marxism itself, they're lacking a language in which to address this this new kind of discourse that has suddenly emerged as so forceful in the 1870s and 1880s. There are on the German side, as is well known, there's this adaptation of Austro-Marxism, the idea that there can be a separate kind of national, national representation for individuals' national interests within Austria-Hungary. But following Hans Mums and in the book, I identify this as really a culturally German project, with the assumption that as socialism progresses, it will also lead to the spread and the victory of German. Sorry, there's a lot of activity in our street for it right now for some reason. It's trash day. Otto Bauer, Karl Kautsky, and others, they believe that as socialism spread, so would German culture. So that meant that Polish and Czech socialists, if they were to maintain themselves within their political environments during the spread of mass politics, had themselves to become in some sense nationalist. Comparatively speaking, compared with the right, this is here's the answer about adaptation. It's a relatively tolerant kind of nationalism, which, for example, in the Czech case, provides for equal rights for German culture under the new Czechoslovak state. But at the same time, it's decidedly ethnic. A turning point for me was in the 1890s, as I mentioned, when Czech Social Democrats were faced with the question about whether they would support a watering down of this ideology of Czech states' rights or Bohemian states' rights. And when they acceded to even thinking about that, right, to saying that the Czech lands, Bohemia, might not be fully Czech, they immediately began facing challenges from among other socialists, right? So what I say, in broader answer to your question, what I say in the book is that nationalism, this nationalist, these understandings of the need to defend threatened people, this kind of discourse, this kind of politics, insinuates itself upon all other kinds of politics, beginning with liberalism. Nationalism was originally a liberal project, beginning in the 1840s, but then extending leftward. And late in the book, when I talk about the communist states, Poland, Czechoslovakia, not so much Hungary for specific reasons, but also Yugoslavia, all of these cases, the communist leaderships, Romania, of course, is a well-known case, Bulgaria, all of the communist leaderships find themselves seeking legitimacy through nationalist, certain kinds of nationalist poses. So I guess, the book, the theme of the book is indeed, therefore, the way in which nationalism isn't so much its own politics, but that it colors politics. Right? It's not a separate part of the political spectrum, but that it tends to shape the language of the political spectrum as a whole. It's inescapable. To put a sharp point on it, there is no nationally indifferent politics. Once mass politics emerges, it very quickly becomes framed within the categories, the understandings, the demands, the shame, the shaming of modern nationalism. So it's incredibly powerful, and I think that that's something that one sees most clearly if one does two things that the book does, which is looks at the entire region, right? So if not just one part of it, but Poland down to the South Slav area, and looks at it over about 250 years of time, when you see this theme repeated again and again and growing over time and forming into this extremely strong kind of politics that extends into our day and continues to surprise people.
I'd have stopped my next question in a better way myself. And I know that it's well nigh impossible to offer a comprehensive response format. Nonetheless, I hope you would be willing to hazard a brief response. Why have all major modern political projects been so vigorously tried out and decisively tested in Eastern Europe? What is it about the region that renders it such a dynamic laboratory of modernity's grand narratives?
Well, it's a great question. I think it has to do with its situation, the situation of the countries of the region between these two empires, right? So Nazism, this specific form of fascism, is something that grows out of the German national project, right? And the fact that the German question, in the eyes of ethnic German nationalists, was not settled in 1871, but that a third or more of ethnic Germans, including the family of Adolf Hitler, were left outside that German nation state. And so when after Versailles and after World War I, radical German nationalism becomes a major force, and then the largest force within German politics in the early 1930s, its natural place to look is, of course, East Central Europe, where there are not only lots of ethnic Germans, but also there are territories that, according to Nazi ideology, need to be settled by and held by ethnic Germans, reducing the local Slavic populations in Poland or the Czech lands or Ukraine to slave status, right? So the reason that this diverges, I think, a bit from what people usually think about Eastern Europe. The reason that fascism finds Eastern Europe as a kind of a laboratory or a place where it works itself out does not have to do so much with politics internal to the region. Aside from Hungary and Romania, there was no strong fascist movement within East Central Europe proper, right? The area that I talk about in the book. This is very much the last stage of fulfillment of a radically understood ethnic German project of making finally a German nation state that will include all Germans. And the force that comes to power with that argument, the National Socialist German Workers Party, isn't, of course, satisfied by making ethnically German areas of East Central Europe parts of the German nation state. It wants to go beyond that, right? So that's and of course, it's the relative weakness of the region that makes it possible for Germany to succeed, and also the fact that in the West there is no resolve to actually stand up to Germany, as is well known in the 1930s. And so, what about the other ideology, which is communism? It's the failure of this Nazi project that then opens a vacuum, permitting Marxism-Leninism. So Marxism and its Soviet guys to enter the region. I do think that historically speaking, again, there are, like fascism, there are not really deep roots in the East European region for radical socialism, right? I mean, there are, as is the case in Germany, there's of course a very strong history of moderate social democracy, of moderate revisionist Marxism. That indeed was the case in the Czech lands, Hungary, Poland, Austria, right? South Slav areas, very, very important, very strong moderate social democracy. So there's no, nobody looking at the region in 1939 would have said this region is primed for communist style regimes. But the reason the region is open to that kind of politics after World War II has to do with the collapse of the Nazi project and the desire of the other empire, the more modern version of the Russian Empire, to seek security by creating its own kind of buffer after World War II, and the most secure buffer for Stalin by the late 1940s. There's excellent work by Norman Neymark about this recently, by the way. The most secure buffer was gradually imposing uniformity upon the East European region and what we came to know as the Soviet bloc. And once this happened, it turned out that this region that really was not a region that you would ever thought would have been a staging ground for communist politics indeed became almost indistinguishable from parts of the Soviet Union. The Berkeley political scientist Kenneth Jowett called the East European states replica regimes, Leninist replica regimes. So by 1954, the architecture, the music, the literature, the industry, the science, all of it was done according to Soviet models. So it's extraordinary, actually. I think we don't really understand very well why it was the case that the Soviet model then indeed was transferred to Eastern Europe after 1956, as we know. Or in 1956, there were reactions against the Soviet model, especially in Poland and Hungary. So there's a kind of a, like a sociologist would say, or social historians would say, a kind of a negotiation after that point. That is that the societies of Eastern Europe go differing ways. The Hungarian communists go a relatively pragmatic form of socialism, whereas East Germany's or Czechoslovak communists are known by the 1980s as being hardliners. Nevertheless, there is a startling degree of diversity within the region. So those are the two projects that come to mind when you say why has the region been a sort of a staging ground for modern ideologies. Liberalism, I'm not so sure about, right? Liberalism still has to prove itself within the region. There have been three stages of experimentation, beginning in the 1870s, right, with the creation of the new ethnically based nation states, better known 1918-1919. Those liberal experiments failed relatively quickly. Even Czechoslovakia, there's a question about whether it can be regarded as a liberal regime. And then after 1989, right, until if we'd been speaking 10 years ago, we'd be speaking about the victory of liberalism in Eastern Europe. It's not so clear now. So, why is it that Hungary and Poland, especially Hungary, seem to be experimenting with new kinds of politics? I don't have a good answer for that. But it gets back, I think, to the way in which Orban and Kaczynski are able to manipulate nationalist language for their own purposes that are illiberal, right? That are directly illiberal, and it's shocking to watch, especially for those of us who were active in the 1980s and sympathetic to the dissident movements, to see what's been happening in recent years.
This is exactly where I would like to wrap up the conversation and where you end the book. What are the prospects for a, let's say, post-national Eastern Europe during an era in which liberalism seems to be on the rise?
Yeah, I think the prospects are poor. I don't see an end to the national era at the moment, because it seems to me that it's a language that is continually useful, and not only in Eastern Europe. I mean, look at Brexit, look at France, but look at Northern Ireland, where I was. I mean, we're very concerned these days about what will happen with the hard Brexit within Northern Ireland. Nobody can say there may be a reemergence of certain kinds of divisions that we thought were resolved in the 1990s. There's a very good recent article by Fintan O'Toole, the Irish journalist, talking about the emergence of English nationalism, how in fact British imperialism, and in fact even the ideology of the Union within the United Kingdom, has always in some ways been a project of English nationalism. So if what about the United States of America? Do we see? Do we imagine a post-national future? No. I mean, it's extraordinary how under proper circumstances these nationalist tropes come back. The only thing I could say as somebody who identifies with the center left is that the center left has to itself take cognizance of nationalist concerns, the concerns of people within Poland or Hungary, that their cultures and languages be maintained, and these, if there are concerns of that kind, then people like Donald Tusk and others have to take them seriously. That's indeed a theme of the book, is the way in which radical nationalism, fascism in earlier generations emerges always out of the mistakes of liberals, right? So I would advise liberals not to imagine that there can be a fully post-national future, but to imagine a future in which liberal, and progressive politics can absorb concerns that people have about precisely the long-term narrative of the book, concerns about loss of local tradition and culture, language. Ultimately, I think the concern is best expressed in a by a Russian friend of mine who was sympathetic to Russian minorities living in Latvia, that there was a concern that Russians as a minority had in Latvia, that they, given Latvian school policies, would no longer be able to pass on their own understandings of what was most important in the world, things that they absorb through their own language and culture, right? Things that give meaning to people's existence. It's at that level, I think, that all politicians, especially on the left, are called upon to, you know, to show sensitivity and not simply to, you know, even your question post-national future. I think that if you even imagine that kind of politics, what you do is you stimulate nationalism. So I hate to say this, I'm reminded when I say these kinds of things, a bit of a politician I don't admire, which is Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, who he promoted nationalist politics in the 1920s Soviet Union precisely because he was aware that this is a very strong source of political mobilization. If we wanted to deal with it, one had to accede to its demands. And this indeed was a time, the 1920s, which saw a flourishing of Belarusian, Ukrainian, Armenian, Georgian culture. So that would be my somewhat, somewhat provocative, perhaps, response to your question. I don't believe in such a thing at this moment as in such a thing as a post-national future.
Finally, where has From People Seem to Nations led you? What are you currently working on?
Well, I'm actually working on what's something I view as being a great tragedy of the 20th century, a bit further to the west in Austria. But Austria is one of the cases of the region. The division between moderate socialist and moderate Christian politics. So the solution to the problem of fascism after World War II was for the center right and center left to come together in Western Europe. Obviously, this didn't happen in Eastern Europe. But what I find frustrating in working in the 1920s and 30s, especially in, say, Austria, Italy, Germany, France, to some extent, also Poland, is the way that the center right and center left failed to cooperate. I think also in our own day, if there's a solution, if there's a way to move forward, it is through some combination of center right and center left politics. So my concrete project is actually about the 1920s in Austria and the emergence of phenomenon known as Austrofascism. So that's something I've been reading a lot about and hope to write a relatively brief book. And after that, something larger on democratization. So the success of democratic politics after World War II in Western Europe was due precisely to the way in which Christian Democrats and Social Democrats collaborated with some liberals, right? And so I'm interested in simply retelling the story in which that was possible. It has to do with moderation of Marxism and a modernization of Catholicism at the same time. James Chappell of Duke University has written a very interesting book about modernization of Catholic politics. Sherry Berman at Columbia has written interesting things about the moderation of social democracy. Very important study, not as well known as it should be among historians. So I'd like to kind of take these two sorts of scholarly interests, center left and center right, and bring them together. I think that's what I'm interested in doing.
Not wait to read it. Thank you, Dr. Connolly, for joining me and discussing your work for New Books in Eastern European Studies. It was a vast pleasure talking to you today.
It was a great pleasure talking to you, Vlada. Best wishes.